Taiwan crosses the threshold today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Same-sex marriage is now legal in Taiwan. It's the only spot in Asia where same-sex couples can marry.
Any LGBT person in the region will be paying attention to this and will be pretty excited.
We'll look at the ripple effects across Taiwan's neighbors. Plus, Switzerland votes on gun control on Sunday. For a European country, it has a lot of guns, but not so many bullets.
So that is the irony of the Swiss gun laws. Ammunition is not stored in the house.
And teaching Italian teens to sing R&B.
When I came to Italy, I never thought that there was so much love for American music. It was just such a shock for me.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Joyous celebrations in Taiwan today after Parliament there voted to recognize same-sex marriage.
We're happy today. We feel like we're in a dream because today we can finally be sure to know that we can marry on May 24th and also to give our children parental rights, finally.
The vote makes Taiwan the first in Asia to recognize same-sex marriage. Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, tweeted, "Love won. We took a step towards true equality." The World's Patrick Nguyen has been following the story from his base in Bangkok. What has been the reaction in Taiwan? What have you heard?
Lots of celebration, lots of activity on Twitter, not just in Taiwan, but around the region. Any LGBT person in the region will be paying attention to this and will be pretty excited. I have to say, it wasn't entirely something that came out of the blue. Taiwan has like this massive gay pride parade that brings in people from all over the region. It's known for having a thriving gay positive scene. And legally, you know, the constitutional court had said, you guys got to get your laws in line within the next 2 years. And they snuck in right under the deadline, got their laws in line, and here we are.
We'll get to how the Taiwan move on same-sex marriage resonates throughout the region in a moment. But what exactly in Taiwan has been approved?
Gay marriage. Okay, so that's a really big deal because, you know, other countries in the region are maybe talking about same-sex unions, and even that seems kind of far-fetched and completely impossible, frankly, in some parts of the region, such as, say, Indonesia, right? And I have to say, you're going to see a lot of jubilation on TV, which is great. Not everyone will be happy with this. It's actually unclear to me if most people in Taiwan are happy with this. There was a referendum last year where roughly 70% of voters said they did not want marriage equality. That vote is void because the constitutional court says, no, you know, it's constitutional, you have to allow this. But that signals that there may be pushback. There's a lot of strong Christian force in Taiwan that may be pushing back on this in the future.
So Taiwan is now the first country in Asia to legalize same-sex marriage. I'm curious to know what the rest of the region thinks of all this.
If I had to put money on what the next Asian country to allow, let's say, same-sex unions, Thailand, where I'm talking to you from right now. Back in the winter of last year, the military government passed a civil partnership bill. So this is not marriage. It's a same-sex union that would allow people to have proper medical visits and inherit property and everything. So that law awaits the new government in Thailand, which is currently being formed. Here's a strange one, Marco. The Philippines, okay? Rodrigo Duterte, the president there, architect of a horrific war on drugs, which has seen more than 10,000 deaths, someone who called the U.S. ambassador a gay slur a few years ago.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, he supports same-sex unions, but that's an interesting one. And then worst on the list, you can probably guess, Brunei.
Yeah, let's talk about Brunei for a second because, I mean, they just severely increased penalties for being a homosexual.
In fact, Brunei's government came out and defended this to the UN, to the EU, saying, stoning and amputation for gay sex, but it's very unlikely we would actually carry through with that. Will not be very reassuring to people that live there. It really doesn't get much worse than that.
So even in countries where same-sex unions are being considered, does the LGBT communities in those places still get worried about homophobia?
Oh, absolutely. And we're talking about a big range of different communities. So if you are LGBT in, say, Aceh, a part of Indonesia, that's a very heavily Orthodox Islamic place where they have Sharia police. You are perhaps living in fear. Within the same country, if you go to the capital, Jakarta, you may be able to live a more open life. Move over into Thailand and you can walk down the street holding hands as a same-sex couple, and it's very unlikely that you will run into any problems until, of course, let's say you try and get married and get full legal recognition. So all of these different communities are dealing with different sets of problems, some dire and immediate, some people living in fear, and others fighting for the type of legal recognition that, you know, let's face it, in the United States was only given in our recent history.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
From Taiwan now to mainland China and to the western region of Xinjiang, where there are currently more than a million Uyghur Muslims in detention camps. When you read the details about the mass incarceration program there and the Chinese security apparatus in Xinjiang, it all seems very unreal and very far away from our lives here in the U.S. But it is closer than you might think. From the Wall Street Journal, we learn how Western companies have ties to what looks like a system of forced labor in Xinjiang. Ryan Thumb is on the line with me. He's an expert on Xinjiang at the University of Nottingham. Lay out the connection for us between global companies, including American companies, and the mass incarceration campaign in Xinjiang.
Well, there are different levels of connection, but the most common one, the one we have the most evidence for, is Western companies sourcing raw materials or basic manufactures from other companies in Xinjiang, some of them state-owned, that use a very particular kind of labor. And that is members of ethnic minorities who are forced by the government into training programs that combine both job training and political indoctrination. And then when they're done with these training camps, then they are assigned to a factory. That is separate from the mass internment camps, which the Chinese government also tries to sell as job training. There are some connections there. For example, one company has a joint venture with another Chinese company that is controlled by an arm of the Chinese state that runs its own internment camps.
So basically you're saying companies like Adidas and The Gap and H&M and others are somewhere along the supply chain for materials originating in these labor camps.
That's right. There's a very good chance that if you have an H&M shirt, that some of the thread in there was spun by people who were part of these involuntary training systems and then assignment to work at a factory.
So from what you know, Ryan, is it fair to describe what's happening in these camps in Xinjiang as forced labor?
It's really impossible right now for members of these predominantly Muslim minority groups to say no to any government program. They know that they can be disappeared into one of these internment camps that hold a million or 2 million people at any moment with no criminal charge. So it's really not safe to say no, although some people do. There's one report of people that had escaped from the tomato paste jobs that they were assigned to. But essentially, it's an environment in which there's no way to give consent. And so I think it has to be considered a form of forced labor.
So how have Western companies that are part of the supply chain of materials that are produced at these camps, how are they responding to these allegations?
I think some of them are probably genuinely surprised, and others probably, you know, didn't put much effort into knowing what was going on in the first place. Adidas has really been a bright spot. They say that they ended the use of labor that was assigned by the state back in 2016, which is quite impressive. That's really the moment when things were starting to get very bad in Xinjiang. Other companies have really just tried to make the issue go away. Volkswagen has ties to production in Xinjiang, and their CEO has rather implausibly expressed complete ignorance about even the existence of the internment camp system and assimilation program for Uyghurs.
I know some people have suggested a boycott of companies that are in the supply chain for some of the goods that come out of these forced labor camps in Xinjiang, but with more than a million people detained in some cases, and it doesn't seem like the supply chain is slowing down, what can a boycott actually do?
Anything that can challenge the way they're doing business there will make the oppression of the Uyghurs and other Turkic Muslims much more costly for the Chinese government.
Ryan Thumb is an expert on Xinjiang in far western China. He's at the University of Nottingham. Ryan, thank you very much for your thoughts for explaining this to us.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Architect Ian Pei died last night, as you've probably heard. He was 102, famous worldwide for his creations like the Glass Pyramid at the Louvre in Paris. But I want to focus on one of his final projects, the Museum of Islamic Art in Doha in Qatar. It's essentially a cubist composition of square blocks stacked up on one another. Pei was at the opening in 2008.
This building is very special to me, simply because it helped me to learn something about another world, another religion, another culture.
Nasser Rabat is a professor of Islamic architecture at MIT. He told me the story behind the museum in Doha.
When he was approached by the Emir of Qatar to build that museum, he told the Emir of Qatar, "But I know nothing about Islamic architecture." So the Emir of Qatar said, "Okay, what do you need to learn?" And he said, "I don't know. I want to see Islamic architecture." So the Emir of Qatar sent him a private jet, and it took him from one Islamic city to the other, where meetings with architects and historians of architecture in those cities were arranged for him.
Wow.
And he didn't like what he saw in North Africa. I think he went to Andalusia, to Alhambra and stuff like that. And then he went to Morocco, and I'm not sure if Tunis. And then the third station was to be Egypt. And in Egypt, he was taken around, and then he was taken to the Mosque of Ibn Tulun, a mosque that was built between 876 and 879 of our era. And he said the following. He said, "In the middle of the Mosque of Ibn Tulun, I had at last found what I came to consider to be the very essence of Islamic architecture." And in the middle of the Mosque of Ibn Tulun, which is really funny, is a fountain structure that does not belong to the mosque. It was added in 1292 by a sultan who took refuge in the mosque, and he vowed that if he comes out alive of that problem that he had, he will refurbish the mosque. So he added this fountain, and the fountain is basically a square with a dome on top of it. So he found in that pure small fountain structure the inspiration behind the museum.
What do you think about that? That's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Isn't that how many architects usually approach the notion of historical influence? I mean, architectural education used to be filled with images. You show students images of buildings that are iconic, and somehow they sort of like sublimate these images, and they come later on in their own design. But I should tell you that Ian Pei actually maintained his modernist purity to the end. So his design does not really, from the outside at least, does not really look like the fountain. And on the inside, it seems to me that he compensated, or maybe overcompensated, by building these huge Mukarna squinches, triangular squinch structures on the four sides that immediately inscribe the building within the long series of domical structure from the Islamic tradition.
It sounds like you're not a total fan of the building.
I think you're reading too much into it. No, I am actually. Let's say that I critically love the building.
Okay. What do you love about it?
That purity, that simplicity of the form, and the fact that it's standing there on its own as a little jewel in the Gulf of Doha. And I don't know if you know, but Ian Pei requested that his building be built on an artificial island so that it doesn't get encumbered by what is extremely fashionable in Doha, which is all of these high rises that are being built on usually actually reclaimed land.
Nasser Rabat, professor of Islamic architecture at MIT. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Museum of Islamic Art's simple facades and strong angles make it a stunning building. We have photos of it and seven other Ian Pei buildings that are not the Louvre, all at theworld.org. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. In Switzerland, they're doing something this weekend that's not going to happen in the U.S. anytime soon. They're holding a national vote on tighter gun restrictions. It's all tied into whether Switzerland should get in line with a European Union ban on automatic weapons, as well as tougher rules for licensing and registering firearms. The vote has also generated talk about Switzerland's gun culture. Christine Brian Buxton grew up in the U.S., but she's lived in Switzerland for 20 years and is a dual citizen. First of all, Christine, I understand gun ownership is pretty common in Switzerland, especially compared to other European countries. Why is that?
Here in Switzerland, we still have a mandatory military service. And when the people are finished with their military service, they do bring their guns home, and they are required to store that gun in their basement or their attic until they come up for recall every year for more training.
Guns and bullets?
So that is the irony of the Swiss gun laws, is that ammunition is not stored in the house. The bullets, those are now stored at one of the bunkers nearby.
So the whole idea of gun rights in Switzerland, Christine, what does that mean to the Swiss?
I think in Switzerland, one of the big differences of gun ownership, I was thinking about this, and it comes down to, in the U.S., the whole discourse of guns is about the right to carry. Whereas here in Switzerland, the Swiss people are very, they focus on your rights and responsibilities. And as long as you maintain your responsibility, you may retain that right. So I think as well, if these rights start getting abused, it may be taken away. But until then, the right to gun ownership, the cost is very small here.
I was Googling mass shooting Switzerland, and it turned up mercifully very few results. If you were to ask the Swiss why they think they need gun control, what answers would you typically get?
I think if you asked any Swiss here what gun control they would need, they would say we're doing just fine how it is right now. As you had mentioned earlier, this law that we're voting on this Sunday has more to do with the European Union getting in line with them. The majority of the population realizes that what's most important here is that we remain in the Schengen Agreement.
That's the agreement that allows free travel across the borders in Western Europe.
Exactly.
Right, because Switzerland is not actually part of the EU. So is the EU basically saying if you want to still be part of Schengen, you need to comply with these new rules?
Yeah, that is exactly.
Christine, you're from Alaska, where there are lots of guns and they're used for fairly practical reasons, hunting, food, protection from bears. When you first got to Switzerland, what struck you about the gun reality there compared to what you saw in Alaska?
First of all, it's not part of the conversation here. They just don't play a prominent place in society here.
And even now with this vote on Sunday, I mean, are people talking about it kind of more than usual, or is it still kind of the same? Well, we'll vote. It's the same conversation as before.
It's the same conversation.
I mean, given how many guns there are across Switzerland, do you have a gun like locked away in your basement?
So we do not have a gun yet.
Why yet?
My son, he will be starting his military service in January.
Uh-huh.
So he will have a fully automatic weapon. When he comes home on the weekends, he will be in his uniform carrying his gun with him. And
will it be loaded?
It will not be loaded, and he will not have bullets with him.
Mm. How do you feel about your son coming home with a gun? I mean, even if it's not loaded.
Like you say, growing up in Alaska, I was around guns a lot. Whenever we would go camping, my dad had his bear gun. It did save us once. Mm. But I have to say, having lived outside of the United States now for so long, I'm a lot more nervous around guns now. In my own house, that's fine. But when I see somebody in the U.S. with an open carry gun, I have to say I get quite nervous that that person could be pulling that out at any minute. Who's to say that that is a safe person?
Christine, Brian Buxton lives on the outskirts of Geneva. Thanks very much for being with us. Are you going to vote on Sunday?
I am. We have a lot of them this weekend, though. I've got to start doing my research on the other items.
Over to Britain now, where Prime Minister Theresa May continues to try to find a way to lead Britain out of the EU. Her Brexit plan still doesn't have enough support.
If anything, I would suspect that things have gone backwards for Downing Street and for the Prime Minister since last time they had a vote.
That's May's former spokesperson, Joey Jones. He was referring there to the fact that the British Parliament has already voted on May's plan and turned it down three times. Today, her Conservative Party tried to find a compromise with the Labour Party. Those talks also collapsed. And now there's growing speculation about how much longer May can hold on as Prime Minister. Regardless of when Brexit happens, or even if it happens, the effects of all this uncertainty are already being felt. One example, 6 months before the Brexit referendum a few years ago, Andreas Goldthaw signed a contract with the University of London to be a professor of international relations. He still works there, but as a native German, Goldthaw and his wife had to make some hard choices.
So we started immediately. We started thinking about our plan. We decided it would be better for us to live in the EU, and for us that meant Berlin. So I would commute, and I did that for most of the last couple of years, from Berlin into London and back. We're not the only ones doing that. So other people are trying to find similar ways of hedging their risk and their uncertainty that comes with Brexit, work visa requirements going forward, and all these things. I mean, generally, academia works in networks. We never work alone. The whole idea that some academic sits in some room with closed doors and writes a big fat book, I mean, it's something that is a thing of the past if it ever existed. We work together in teams. Questions are complex. We need to solve them by way of sourcing in various types of expertise, and that's the way we do it. So academic networks span across Europe and beyond. If one country gets cut out of those networks because of a major shock like Brexit, this doesn't help, of course. It is bad for the country that's concerned, that's the UK. But obviously, on an aggregate level, it's even worse. Them essentially taking a step back and possibly, in part at least, leaving those networks is a very bad thing for all of Europe. So it's not only the UK shooting themselves in the foot. It's a bad thing for European academia and the competitiveness of the academic sector. If you take decisions to leave, if you take up a different job, not only in academia, but elsewhere, this creates path dependencies. You just don't come back. You leave, and you leave for good. So decisions that are being taken right now by myself, my wife, and other people that I know, these are decisions that are not necessarily reversible. These people will be gone. Yeah. I'm looking forward.
Andreas Goldthaw, a European academic, explaining the knock-on effects of Brexit on him and his family, already being felt whether Britain leaves the EU on time or not. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. When U.S. military campaigns are fought from the air, civilians often end up paying the price.
The United States was trying to get rid of a brutal terrorist group. But the way they do that matters, and the impact on civilians and people who live there really matters.
Casualties and unintended consequences, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've heard a lot over the past week about the possibility of a military confrontation with Iran and how the Trump administration has been reviewing the Pentagon's plans for that possibility. So this might be a good time to remember that the U.S. is already involved in various conflicts around the world, conflicts that often have unintended consequences. Here's more from the world's Shirin Jafari.
Ibrahim Hiri made a living as a driver in Somalia. Back in March, he visited his family's farm a few hours outside of Mogadishu. He spent the day working there, and when he was done, he got in his minivan and started to drive back home.
We could not reach Ibrahim's phone because the phone was unavailable.
Ahmed Hassan Hiri is Ibrahim's brother. He says initially, his family wasn't too worried when Ibrahim didn't pick up. Maybe he wasn't getting cell phone reception. But hours went by and no sign of Ibrahim, which was unusual.
Ibrahim, he didn't away a night in his home.
Ahmed says his brother always made sure to be home by nighttime. That's why he began to get a feeling that something might have gone wrong.
We didn't get any update or report from Ibrahim.
It wasn't until 24 hours later that Ibrahim's sister got a call from a stranger. Some locals had found Ibrahim's body on the road, along with what remained of his minivan. They'd found a SIM card and inserted it in a cell phone. They called up the first number that showed up on the screen. It belonged to Ibrahim's sister.
My sister, she could not speak. My sister's husband took over the phone and gathered the information from the person.
Ahmed's brother-in-law asked the man on the line to take a photo of the body and send it to him.
His face was not destroyed, but the other bodies was badly destroyed. We recognized it, Ibrahim's face.
Ahmed believes his brother was killed in an American airstrike. The day after Ibrahim was killed, the U.S. military command in Africa issued a press release. It said it had conducted an airstrike in the area aimed at the terrorist network Al-Shabaab. Ahmed says his brother was no terrorist.
He ever, never involved it, whether it's Al-Shabaab or even he didn't take a gun during his life.
Ibrahim leaves behind 7 children and a pregnant wife. Now his family wants answers.
The U.S. government is a big government, and I believe it is where the democracy and humanity come from. And we are requesting to investigate that he was innocent.
And they hope an investigation might also lead to compensation for his loss.
The United States flew 1,500 missions today, 700 of which were bombing raids.
In the past 2 decades, the U.S. has fought in many conflicts around the globe, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, just to name a few. Throughout the years, the U.S. has been inconsistent when it comes to counting civilian casualties and compensating survivors.
It's something that really evolved in the ground in response to the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Erica Gaston is a human rights lawyer who's researched the impact of war on civilians. She says when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq in the early 2000s, it didn't have a standard policy on compensating survivors. Meanwhile, activists were scrambling to draw attention to civilian deaths. Gaston says that activism, as well as pressure from human rights groups, led to a change in U.S.'s attitude. American commanders got access to funds that they could use as, quote, condolence payments.
And so initially that coalesces to where you start to get these payments happening more on the ground.
The process wasn't perfect, Gaston says, but from what she saw, it made a difference.
Every family has their own personal experience with grief and loss. But in general, in Afghanistan, it's considered a sign of respect.
Recently, the U.S. military has relied more on drones and airstrikes, in Syria, for example. But fighting from the air has created additional concerns for civilian safety, says Daphne Eviatar of Amnesty International.
There's a limited amount you can see from the air. You can see a person, you can see a building. If you bomb a building, you can't see who is inside of it.
Last October, a Pentagon spokesman told reporters that the U.S. takes civilian casualties seriously, but it doesn't have the manpower in Syria to conduct investigations on the ground. But Eviatar doesn't see this as an adequate explanation.
The United States was trying to get rid of a brutal terrorist group, but the way they do that matters, and the impact on civilians and the people who live there really matters.
The U.S.-led campaign against the Islamic State in Syria might be winding down. But American airstrikes in Somalia have tripled since President Trump took office. I asked the U.S. Africa Command about the civilian casualties in Somalia. In an emailed statement, it said it's assessing reports of civilian casualties and that the U.S. has never paid compensation to any Somali citizen as a result of an airstrike. As for Ahmed Hassan Hiri, whose brother was killed, he says he doesn't even know who to contact or how.
There is no organized institutions. Even we don't know how to report our problems.
He says his sister-in-law has been struggling emotionally and financially since her husband's death.
She was not feeling well. I don't think she will forget her loved one.
Ahmed says he wishes the U.S. would do more to distinguish between extremist groups like Al-Shabaab and innocent people like his brother. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Last month, Arab pro-democracy activist Iyad el-Baghdadi got a surprise visit from intelligence officers in Norway, the country where he's lived since 2014 when he was granted asylum there. The officers told el-Baghdadi that he was a target of an unspecified but credible threat from Saudi Arabia. He wasn't that surprised. El-Baghdadi has been a popular critic of various Middle Eastern regimes and rulers since the Arab Spring, and last fall in particular, criticizing Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. That's when he started hearing that the House of Saud was not happy about it.
Well, as far back as October, I did receive a tip from a source within Saudi Arabia, a friendly source, let's say, you know, basically warning me, saying that you should up your own personal security and your digital security because you're being discussed as someone who is, you know, damaging MBS's reputation in the English language.
Is it clear whether you became a target of the Saudis before or after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?
I think it was my activity after Jamal's murder that actually escalated this threat. You know, I think before that I was kind of more an annoyance or a critic. But after Jamal's death, I think their sensitivity and also the stakes, I think, were just higher for everybody.
Did you and Jamal Khashoggi see things eye to eye, or did you have different approaches to human rights and press freedom?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting question, mainly because I often tell people that Jamal and I were not supposed to be friends.
Why is
I mean,
that?
Jamal, for the longest time, you know, for most of his career, Jamal was a Saudi government insider who was a loyalist to the Saudi regime. And, you know, he was basically one of the ruling elites, really. I mean, he was a member of the elites in Saudi Arabia. So someone like me, who is, you know, more of an Arab Spring figure or, you know, a revolutionary figure, and someone, you know, who is an opponent to the ruling regimes in, you know, the dictatorships in the Middle East, we're not supposed to see eye to eye. And this is why I think the friendship, when it actually developed, was something very special, because it really developed in the last year of Jamal's life. So I was in touch with Jamal and I respected him for his intellect and for his honesty for a long time, of course. And we had followed each other digitally for years. But it was only during this last year that it went from being, you know, kind of a mutual respect, but also peppered with a lot of disagreements, to more of an alliance.
Do you feel a responsibility to carry on the work that he was doing?
Oh, absolutely. He has a very interesting legacy. And I think his shift from, you know, doing politics the old way to gravitating towards activists is, I think, interesting, because I think he realized that, you know, the rise of Mohammed bin Salman also meant the end of old politics, the old way of doing politics in Saudi Arabia. And I think that made him realize that maybe activism is the way, you know, it's valid here. He was someone who was committed to free speech, committed to freedom of the press, regardless whether he agreed with a certain position or not. And he told me several times that the Arab Spring had a deep impact on him, that it changed him from inside. And I believed it. Mm. So absolutely, part of what energizes us, of course, is loyalty to his legacy.
Iyad, you've been known for using satire and humor in your criticism of various Arab governments. I mean, is that still a thing, or has it kind of gotten to the point where you don't find humor anymore in any of this?
I love the question, Marco. I mean, initially, the kind of sarcastic humor was really humor that kind of covers up your pain, really. But it's also because a lot of dictators, I mean, their behavior is legitimately ridiculous, especially when on top of that behavior, on top of the really ridiculous narratives that they employ, with that comes, you know, the threat of violence. Sometimes the best thing you can do is really laugh at them. Humor is really part of the ecosystem of resistance, and I think in the Middle East and also globally. So I think we're going to continue to do that. I don't think their brutality should really separate us from our ability to crack a joke at their expense.
You've lived in Oslo since 2014. Have you changed how you're living your day-to-day life since hearing about the threat to you?
Well, I mean, I'm disinclined to answer the question, Marco, just because I've been instructed not to comment about my living arrangements or anything to do with my security arrangements at all.
Iyad el-Baghdadi, a pro-democracy activist living in Oslo and, according to recent intelligence, is a target of the Saudi government. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I've always wondered, how can I sing like Mariah Carey? Seriously. Well, there's a voice coach who can show me. Yep, she's the one, Cheryl Porter, based in Vicenza in Italy. In that clip, she's teaching an Italian boy to sing Beyoncé in perfect English. Damn. So it is possible. Cheryl's videos teaching Italian teens to be R&B divas have gone viral. My colleague Carol Hills recently caught up with Cheryl Porter.
I just love watching your videos. That's great.
Oh, thank you, honey. Thank you so much.
Wow. So you have to tell me a little about yourself. Where are you from and when did you start singing?
I'm from Chicago. I'm from the south side of Chicago, born and raised. And I studied opera for 5 years at Northern Illinois University. And after college, I came here to Italy, actually further my career and further my studies in music and opera music. And I've been here for about 23 years, Carol, can you believe
Whoa.
It? Yes, 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 yes. It's amazing. When I came to Italy, I never thought that there was so much love for American music. It was just such a shock for me because I thought that in Italy it was just mostly Puccini and Verdi and Rossini. And I never knew that there was so much love for gospel and for jazz and for soul and R&B. And it's great to teach that culture and pass that culture along to people who are not from the States.
Sando and with delay vibrato. Tell me I was wrong. Thank you for all you've done. Forgive all your mistakes. Forgive all your mistakes. Mistake, mistakes. Forgive all your mistakes.
What's the funniest scenario you've ever experienced teaching where a kid comes in and asks to learn some song and you're like, what?
Let me think. I can't think of anything right now. What cos'è la cosa più difficile? Sto provando di pensare.
I wonder if like some little kid came in and wanted to sing some song and didn't really know what the lyrics meant, and the lyrics turned out to be like kind of inappropriate or naughty.
Oh, that happens all the time. It happens all the time. I said, well, honey, do you know what this song means? So it's important when you're singing in a different language to understand every word, to understand what the song is talking about. So I try to make my students, when they bring a song to study, they have to translate the song word by word and also phrase by phrase before they start singing some sexy lyrics at 7 years old.
So do you think your students are learning anything else about American culture besides just the songs?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because music is culture, music is it's history. And if you teach a song about R.E.S.P.E.C.T. and Aretha Franklin song, you have to know where that comes from. You have to know something about the civil rights movement. You have to know something about human rights. You have to know something about what those lyrics mean.
Don't mess with Aretha.
Don't mess with Aretha.
Do you give them the background of the songs they're learning and the
lyrics? Absolutely. I'll give them the background, or if I don't, I'll tell them they have to study it because they have to know the culture. They have to know the story behind each song, behind the composer, behind the artist, because that's the most important part. We are the continuation of the story, not just the song that comes in one ear and out the next.
Damn, girl. Vergognosamente bravo.
American voice coach Cheryl Porter wrapping up another lesson there in her studio in Vicenza, Italy. She was speaking with my colleague here at The World, Carol Hills. Watch Cheryl in action teaching her students how to sing like Beyonce and Christina Aguilera. That's at theworld.org. Violent attacks on health workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo are seriously hindering efforts to contain an Ebola outbreak there. That's according to the World Health Organization this week. And that violence is being fueled by rumors and conspiracy theories about the disease. Nicole Fassina knows about this firsthand. She's with the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent, coordinating the Ebola response in Goma in eastern DRC. I asked Fassina why she thinks there's so much mistrust among local residents.
I think, first of all, we have to see it from their perspective, from the community. We have an active Ebola outbreak where we also see an outbreak of measles, we see an outbreak of cholera, population movement, ongoing conflict, and we can understand that there's a level of mistrust in the community, especially when they see something like Ebola as being from outside their community and question whether it is real.
What kind of stories are you encountering that are causing confusion and mistrust?
So we hear a few different stories. The first is, as we mentioned already, that Ebola is not a real disease. And of course, then what we're doing to try to shift this paradigm is use Ebola survivors to go back into their communities, into their schools, discuss with their family and friends and their loved ones that it is a real disease and they did survive it because they sought treatment in a timely manner and they went to the Ebola treatment center. Another example that we hear is through a process we call safe and dignified burials.
Yeah, I'm curious, what rumors around burial practices did you have to deal with?
One of the ones we heard, this is around the use of body bags. So, of course, to bury the dead, we require body bags. And we were using black, non-transparent body bags. And this was seen as something, you know, the community weren't able to see their loved ones as they were being buried. And so then we've adapted our response to use white and or clear body bags where possible.
And using white or clear body bags allows the community to see precisely who's in the bag. Am I getting that right?
Yes, that's correct. So it brings a bit more of a human approach to a medical, safe and dignified burial practice.
It seems, Nicole, that a lot of these issues seem to be about there being an other, the presence of an outsider coming into this community, in this case a foreign entity, explaining a new emergence of a deadly virus. Am I correct about that? And ultimately, how do you deal with that outsider dynamic? Because that doesn't go away, does it?
You're very correct. And let's take it for a minute from our own perspective. If we had someone who came to our house to take away our loved ones in a way that we weren't used to, and further, that was a professional who is covered in a full protective equipment, so this is a white suit that covers the full body and you're wearing a mask, we would also be concerned and we would be scared and we may have some resistance. And so we can understand that there is this level, you know, of needing to involve the community and to explain to them these processes.
I'm just curious, how optimistic are you right now? I mean, the headlines are varied, to say the least.
It is a very concerning situation that we're in, and there are many operational challenges. So while there have been some really good and positive success stories on Ebola survivors, we're really urging the donor community and the humanitarian and the frontline workers to keep up their strong work because the outbreak is not yet over.
Nicole Fassina, the Regional Ebola Operations Coordinator in Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo for the International Federation of the Red Cross. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Finally today, there's a new album by British reggae legend Steel Pulse, the first for the band in 15 years. It's called Mass Manipulation, a return to the band's focus on social justice issues. Lead vocalist David Hines told me that while many things have changed in the last decade, racial disparities are still a reality on both sides of the Atlantic.
Because at the end of the day, when you look at the whole scheme of things, you know, the world has been duped where tracks like Don't Shoot, for example, because of the Ferguson incident and the George Zimmerman murder of Trayvon Martin.
I says don't get disillusioned by this racist institution. The bigots are out there with their weapons too.
And we wrote songs called Paint It Black. It's not Mick Jagger's song. It's actually a song about the first black president of the United States, which means, you know, painting the White House black. And, you know, we wrote songs like World Gone Mad explains itself about politicians have failed us. Religion has always been failing us. And it's become evident, you know, when you see things like terrorism activities and racism that have all been done in the name of God.
Now racial wars upon us.
When I hear the song World Gone Mad and you sing about nuclear war upon us, I mean, we're now talking North Korea and Iran, not the Soviet Union, but it does echo some of your lines from the 1970s, the idea of Babylon falling. Did you ever think that in the 1970s that now in 2019 you'd be coming back to some of these same themes?
Really had no idea whatsoever. We didn't even look that far ahead. When we started out in the 70s, as a matter of fact, we just had a concept, thought we had something to say, and that was it. And didn't realize that we'd have captivated the world as much as we did, you know, for the next four decades.
In the liner notes to Mass Manipulation, there's a little sidebar referring to the song Don't Shoot, and it has a headline, The 54 Counted, Remembered Always, followed by the names of 54 men in the U.S., including Tamir Rice and Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin, Philando Castile, people who were killed by police. You're a reggae band. You're based in the U.K. For you personally, make the connection between these 54 men and your own life in England and why you wanted to memorialize these people.
I was always attracted to world politics to begin with, and I was always attracted to what was happening in the United States. At age 14, we had local newspapers within the black community that saw George Jackson walking in chains. Age 9, I saw images of Malcolm X on the TV set looking up at us with holes in his chest. And all we've done is matured and have sort of echoed the same sentiments that was happening currently within the United States right up till this present time. So I think that's one of the main reasons why America's been so much, very much attracted to this band. And this is why they can relate to us, you know. Wow, I didn't know guys like you came from England knew about what we were doing.
David Hines, singer, songwriter, and co-founder of Steel Pulse, out with their first album in 15 years, Mass Manipulation. Thank you very much for your time. Great to meet you.
And thank you very much, sir.
For distraction, mass manipulation. Headed for damnation, mass manipulation.
That'll do it for us today. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. You have yourselves a great weekend.
What you gonna do? Is this your curfew?
PRI, Public Radio International.